This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear a report from our own Michael Ratner, who's in the Western Sahara Desert in Africa.
Michael is there in part to support the freedom struggle of the Polisario Liberation Front.
We'll speak with an attorney from the ACLU. They're seeking documents related to reproductive health care policies for unaccompanied immigrant children in the care of federally funded Catholic agencies.
It's a separation of church and state issue. The Catholic bishops say, even though they've got a contract that indicates otherwise, that they don't have to comply with the law and they can deny reproductive rights information to the young women and girls under their charge.
We'll hear about an unprecedented reparations package in Chicago.
$5.5 million in the first payment ever of reparations for torture by the Chicago Police Department.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Our own Michael Ratner recently attended the 11th Fi Sahara International Film Festival in the Western Sahara Desert in Africa. He brings us up to date on the festival and the larger issue of Sahrawi refugee camps in southwestern Algeria. He also reminds us about the anniversary of the United States Contra torture and murder of Ben Linder in Nicaragua.
This is Michael Ratner speaking to you all from Madrid, Spain, where I have just come back from a trip to the Western Sahara. This will be a short update about that trip, a longer one to be had in the future. I went to the Western Sahara as part of a film festival called Fi Sahara and to visit the refugee camps of the Sahrawi people who live in refugee camps in the south of Algeria. Most people have not heard of this liberation struggle, but for almost 40 years, the people of the Western Sahara have been trying to regain their homeland from Morocco. The Western Sahara was formerly Spanish Sahara. It's the last remaining colony in Africa. It's bordered on the north by Morocco, on the east by Mauritania, and on the northeast by Algeria. Perhaps there are 400,000 Sahrawi people that are led by the Polisario Front, which is the official government of the Sahrawi people. I went, as I said, as part of the film festival, the 11th edition of the film festival. This year there were some 300 activists who came. There were films, but there was also a tremendous amount of attention to the situation of the people of the Western Sahara and in the refugee camps. And in large part, the film festival was there to give a high profile to their struggle for liberation and to be in solidarity with them. There were a number of other important visitors that came, including Nora Morales de Cortines, who's the mother of the Plaza de Mayo from Argentina, who has been in that struggle for decades. She was there in solidarity with the many people in the Western Sahara who have lost their own relatives through disappearances and murder by the Moroccan government. It's a very difficult trip. One has to fly eventually to southern Algeria, a military airport called Tindouf, and from there one takes a car 6 to 8 hours into the hot, hot Western Sahara. One lives with families in their huts and or tents, both of which they have in the refugee camps, and during the day it could go as high as 115 degrees. This time we went to the farthest refugee camp, which is called the Dakhla refugee camp. Dakhla was a city originally in Western Sahara, in the part that is now occupied by Morocco. They fled and they set up their refugee camp in southern Algeria, naming it after the city they fled from. Life in the camps is hard, to put it mildly. The place they are in the Western Sahara has water, but little else. No trees, no vegetation, nowhere to raise any animals, and the Sahrawi people were nomads. And of course, they can no longer be that from the refugee camp. There's no electricity or very little, sometimes a bit on solar. That's how they ran the film festival. But life is not easy. The entire economy of the camp is dependent on the United Nations High Commissioner of Refugees and money that comes from the United Nations. Oftentimes the men will work outside the camp, but in fact, most of the income, food, et cetera, of the camp comes from the United Nations. As I said, most people have not heard of this liberation struggle, but for almost 40 years, the people of the Western Sahara have been trying to regain their homeland from Morocco. The Western Sahara was formerly known as Spanish Sahara. It's the last remaining colony in Africa. I want to repeat that, the last remaining colony in Africa. Perhaps there are some 400,000 Sahrawis left, as I said, led by the Polisario. Here's what happened, a bit of the history. The Spanish Sahara was put on the decolonization list by the United Nations, along with many other countries in Africa. They'd, of course, been divided up and taken by the big powers, imperial powers, in the late 19th century. In 1975, Spain was in the process of giving up the Western Sahara, in part, or Spanish Sahara at that time, in part because of the chaos around Franco's sickness and dying, and it essentially allowed, or perhaps it gave authority, for the Moroccans to march in and conquer Western Sahara. Thousands of the Sahrawi people fled. Many of them were killed and disappeared. Mauritania on the east also marched in. And unfortunately and sadly, but not unexpected, the United States and France were collaborators in this takeover by Morocco of Spanish Sahara. What's remarkable to me about it is the march by the Moroccans with their military into the Spanish Sahara took place the day after, literally the day after, the International Court of Justice recognized the Sahrawi people had a right to self-determination. In other words, Morocco had no right. It was the people of the Western Sahara who had the right to determine their future, and that Morocco had no claims to the land. So it was a completely illegal invasion, contrary to international law, contrary to the United Nations Charter, which obviously does not allow such invasions. But of course, when you look at how the countries reacted, and you recall what happened when Saddam Hussein in 1993 marched into Kuwait, the United States and a few other allies screamed, just screamed, you can't cross an international border, you can't conquer another country. They put together a coalition and they pushed Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. Well, nothing like that happened to the people of the Western Sahara. So after the invasion of Morocco and thousands having fled to the east toward and into Algeria, then Morocco did something really nasty. It then, in what's called the Green March, a few months later, marched 300,000 people from Morocco into Western Sahara so that they would begin to have a demographic advantage and really take over the land, take it over literally, and if there were ever a referendum, try and get those people to vote in it. It's called the Green March. The Sahrawis fought back through the Polisario, and they fought back ferociously. So ferociously that for a while, Morocco had almost lost the war. Then they got funding from Saudi Arabia, arms from some other places, probably France. And in 91, the Polisario hadn't lost yet, but neither had they won. And likewise, Morocco hadn't lost, but neither had they won. And there was a ceasefire. The ceasefire had in it the promise of a referendum administered through the United Nations. As we speak today, that referendum has never occurred. It's never occurred because Morocco refuses to really engage in the referendum, and the United Nations refuses to push them and make them do so. It's a complete, really a complete outrage. In addition to not only the conquest, the moving of people in the Western Sahara, the Moroccans built a 2,500-kilometer wall going north to south that separates most of the land on one side, which Morocco, which is a ceasefire line, and that 2,600-kilometer wall is lined with mines, and so the people on the east side of that wall cannot go into their homelands at all. There are still many Sahrawis living under occupation in the west of the wall, but the wall really divides large part of it into occupied territory and a slim part that is not occupied. It's a ceasefire line. As I said, it's mined. There's Moroccan soldiers. And interestingly, who helped the Moroccans build that wall? It's really a big sand dune with barbed wire and mines. Who helped build it? The United States and Israel. The occupation continues. The conquest continues. The pushing out of the Sahrawi people continues. And the U.S. and France let it continue and really support it. WikiLeaks in the last few weeks came out with a number of documents showing the utter duplicity and hypocrisy of the United States. And just recall this in terms of thinking about U.S. support. A few weeks ago, there was a series of articles about the Clinton Foundation taking money from a corporation in Morocco. What was the corporation? It was a phosphate corporation, because phosphate is one resource that the Western Sahara has, and they're one of the most important resources in the world. It's how fertilizer is made, and there's a limited amount, and it's beginning to run out. There are other resources in the Western Sahara. There's very good fishing off the coast. There's a potential for oil, and it's used for tomatoes as well by Morocco. Recently, there was a vote in the United Nations, actually a week ago. In that vote, the question was whether the UN mandate, which continues to take care of the Western Sahara, whether that would continue. It was decided in the UN vote that it would continue, but unlike other UN mandates, there is no human rights monitoring under that mandate. Every other mandate of the UN has such a human rights monitoring. Morocco objected to having such a mandate, and sadly, the United States and France, which are really the controlling people here, went along with not having a human rights mandate. I can just tell you that when I was in the Western Sahara and in the Dakhla refugee camp, that people were extremely upset, particularly the young people, by the failure of the UN to push for the referendum and the failure to have a human rights mandate. It's been 40 years, and now a lot of the people who fled are getting old and even dying. And so you have a younger generation that is very angry having to continue their lives in this refugee camp. From a legal perspective, it's absolutely a violation of international law for Morocco to have done what it's doing. It's a war crime. First, the invasion was a war crime. The occupation continues the war crime. The moving the civilian population from Morocco into Western Sahara is a war crime. And the taking of resources by Morocco from an occupied territory, phosphates, tomatoes, fish, potentially oil, is another war crime. It may remind you all of another struggle going on right now as we speak, and that's Israel and Palestine. There are amazing parallels between the two. Israel invaded the West Bank, conquered it, moved its population in settlements, and exploits the resources of the West Bank. So they're very similar, the two struggles. I would hope to see at some point that a lot of the effort that's being put into the Israeli struggle for the Palestine struggle will also take note of what's going on in Western Sahara. It's a smaller struggle in the sense there's much fewer people. It's not in the center of where all the oil is, but again, it is exactly parallel, or almost exactly, to what Israel has done to Palestine. And let's also recall a similar struggle that was won, that a lot of the listeners, I'm sure, and others may have been involved in, and that was the struggle to free East Timor. East Timor, as people may recall, in the same year, in 1975, was invaded by Indonesia, was given the green light by Kissinger and the president at the time, Ford, and even though it was a small population on a small island, grassroots solidarity around the world ultimately was a key factor in ending the occupation of East Timor. That struggle in East Timor, as well as the BDS movement in Palestine, tells us about what tactics we should be using today to end the occupation of the Western Sahara by Morocco. What needs to be done outside, which is to make to have solidarity with the Palestinians and to demand there be a referendum and that the occupation by Morocco come to an end. There are conceivably BDS tactics to be used against Morocco, certainly against the products that are produced in Morocco, and those kind of efforts have to be made. In addition, while I was there, there was a decision in a very important international lawsuit. The lawsuit was in Spain, and it was under universal jurisdiction law, international law, there was an indictment of 11 high-level Moroccan officials for genocide. That's a major step forward. It's saying to the Moroccans, you can no longer do what you're doing to the Sahrawi people. You will be indicted for it, and there's red warrants issued for those 11 officials that cannot, with any safety, leave Morocco. I can't say what will happen next inside the occupied territories and inside the refugee camps. I know there's desperation. I know there's people who want to begin to fight back again, but it's really a call to the world to finally do justice for the people of the Western Sahara and the Sahrawi people. Outside, I can just say and repeat, we have to move forward and we have to organize now to end an occupation that has gone on much too long. I wanted to mark today an anniversary of the United States Contra torture and murder of Ben Linder in Nicaragua. Many of our listeners may not know who Ben Linder was, but in 1987, at the age of 27, Ben Linder and two Nicaraguans, Sergio Hernandez and Pablo Rosales, were tortured and murdered by the U.S.-backed Contras in Nicaragua. They were doing incredibly wonderful humanitarian work. They were building small dams and rivers to generate electricity for villages in the north of Nicaragua. This was, of course, during the height of the U.S.-sponsored war against the Sandinistas and the Nicaraguan people. And the group building the small hydroelectric, they're hydroelectric, but they're tiny, had been targeted by the Contras for a long time, and on April 28th, 1987, they murdered them. And the reason I wanted to talk about it is not only because it's the anniversary. I knew Ben, and actually he was one of the Center for Constitutional Rights clients and one of my clients. I was close to his parents, and I remember having a conversation with Ben on one of his trips before he went back to Nicaragua during the war. And he wasn't at all worried about being killed or injured. What he was worried about is whether the United States was going to take his passport away so that he could no longer travel. I remember the conversation perfectly. And then, of course, I worked with their parents. We brought a lawsuit because of his murder. And we actually achieved some result, but not the ultimate result. What we did was sued the Contra leadership, which were living in Miami. Think about that. They're running this illegal war against the government in Nicaragua, and the leadership is sitting there in Miami. Well, we brought a lawsuit against them in Miami. We had key evidence that he'd been executed because he'd been shot with apparently buckshot of some sort. He was laying on the ground, and then while he was laying on the ground, we believe he was tortured, and then a gun was put to his head, and he was executed. And, of course, that's a war crime. Torture is clearly a war crime. And executing a prisoner is a war crime as well. And we had some evidence of that occurring. We had an autopsy of Ben's body that showed the bullet was done at close range, perhaps 6 inches, and we went to court on that. I got relatively far in the sense that the court sustained the lawsuit could go forward. They said I had jurisdiction, or we had jurisdiction over the Contra leaders in Miami, and that executing a prisoner what they called the Civil War, was a war crime. Unfortunately, when it came to trying to take the depositions and get information from the leadership of the Contras, we were unsuccessful in doing that, and ultimately the case had to be dropped. But it was a major effort we made to try and demonstrate the huge human rights atrocities being committed by the U.S.-backed Contras in Nicaragua. There were others as well, but the Ben Linder case, because of his youth, because of the humanitarian work he was doing, And because he was well known as a clown, actually, in Nicaragua, he used to ride a unicycle around in a clown outfit, and it was partly about getting people to take immunity or vaccination shots, and he was successful in getting people to do that. So today, we remember Ben Linder.
Heidi, Mumia Abu-Jamal is dying in prison from medical neglect, and I understand that an appeal has gone to the UN, to the person in charge of torture there. Can you tell our audience what's going on?
Michael, last week, attorneys Natsu Saito, Kathleen Cleaver, and I submitted what's called an urgent appeal request to Juan Mendez, the special rapporteur on torture, for what we deem life-threatening denial of medical care to imprisoned political activist Mumia Abu-Jamal. And this document lays out the case. Due to his body of work, Mumia qualifies as a human rights advocate, and that as such, the United States government has particular obligation to ensure that the rights and protections guaranteed human rights defenders by international law are respected. As our listeners probably know, Mumia's health continues to deteriorate. When we recorded this, he had been put back in the infirmary at SCI Mahanoy. His skin condition continues to be deeply painful, undiagnosed, and the prison has engaged in some what we call scattershot tests, meaning that they're conducting random tests but really not making an effort to get to the underlying cause of what is causing Mumia's different problems. You know, he's had blood in his urine, he's fatigued, his glucose level, as people probably know, had spiked, his sodium level was up.
He fell into diabetic shock.
Exactly. And people should know that what happened initially, way back in January and February, was that Mumia overslept, something he's never done before. He missed the morning call. And that really should have set off signals. He was punished for that, and then his health began to deteriorate such that a fellow inmate actually went to the prison authorities and said, "You have to take care of this man. You know, he's in trouble." They punished that inmate by moving him to another prison. So we knew that something was wrong, and the prison has made no effort to really properly diagnose him and let him see specialists. Because, for example, the skin condition could be indication of cancer or other serious life-threatening conditions.
Well, we're urging our listeners to call Secretary John Wetzel at the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. And if you'll get a pen, I'm going to give you the phone number. Heidi, before I do that, though, do you have one last word on what we want to try to accomplish here?
In general, we want to allow Mumia access to medical specialists, including an endocrinologist, dermatologist, oncologist. Keep him in more open communication with his attorneys and his family and medical specialists who may want to evaluate his charts. Because that's another thing, is that he's been held for various periods incommunicado, and that's troubling.
So please call Secretary John Wetzel at the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. Mr. Wetzel's phone number is 717-728-2573. Repeat, 717-728-2573. Mr. Wetzel would like to hear from you.
Prohibiting Catholic charities from allowing undocumented immigrant teenagers in their care to access contraception and abortion services, even in cases of rape. The ACLU recently filed a lawsuit to obtain federal government records. The group seeks documents related to reproductive health care policy for unaccompanied immigrant children in the care of federally funded Catholic agencies which do not believe in abortion. Nearly 60,000 unaccompanied minors illegally crossed over the Mexico border in 2014. Approximately one-third were young girls, an astonishing 80% of whom were victims of sexual assault. The government contracts with the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops to care for those children until they can either reunite with a relative or face an immigration hearing. In total, the conference has received $73 million from the U.S. government, with $10 million allocated for the care of unaccompanied minors in 2013 alone. The conference has objected to a regulation proposed by the Obama administration mandating that contractors provide abortion to immigrants who have been raped. In response to the ACLU's request, the conference asserts that they are within their rights to exercise religious freedom while taking care of the minors. Joining us to talk about the lawsuit is ACLU attorney Bridget Amiri. Bridget Amiri, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
We were interested to learn about the issue in general of the number of unaccompanied minors crossing the border, and we had no idea that so many of these young girls had been victims of sexual assault.
Right. So this is something that we have just seen recently, a huge surge of unaccompanied children and teens fleeing their home country because of abuse or sexual assault, gang violence, torture, and they come to the United States on their own, and then they are picked up by Homeland Security, and they are put into the care and custody of the federal government, which subcontracts out all of this work to entities on the ground, including religiously affiliated entities. And almost 80% of women and girls who come across the border are sexually assaulted. And that's why we think it's so crucial that when they come to the United States, that they get access to all critical reproductive health care, including access to abortion and contraception.
Now, I understand that the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops contracts with the government to care for many of these young girls until they're either reunited with a relative or go through an immigration hearing. Are there other groups that also contract with the government that are not religious?
There are a number of contractors that are similar to the USCCB that do provide this care. Some are religious, some are not. The largest other organization is Lutheran Social Services. There are a number of secular organizations across the country that provide care to these teens. But the only problems that we have heard about in terms of access to abortion and contraception come from those people who have been working with teens in Catholic programs.
Yeah, the Conference of Catholic Bishops gets, what, $73 million last year to work with these people, but they refuse to even tell you the number of incidences where these children have been raped or are pregnant. Haven't you started a lawsuit about that?
Right. So we filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit just recently to try to get more information from the federal government about exactly what's happening on the ground. We have heard reports that there are problems of the bishops and the agencies that they work with literally blocking care to abortion and contraception for teens in their care because of their religious beliefs. And also recently, the bishops have filed comments with the federal government in opposition to a law that would require all of these contractors to ensure access to emergency contraception and abortion if the teen was raped while in their care. And they said, we don't want to provide referrals for abortion or contraception. We don't even want to provide information about those services. And we don't even want to notify the federal government that a teenager in our care is seeking those services so that the federal government can step into our shoes and provide that care because it would facilitate care that we have a religious objection to.
Well, wait a minute. I've got an objection as a taxpayer. This is my money that they're getting. If they didn't want the contract, they didn't have to take it. But if they took the contract, they should conform to the law. What do they say to that argument?
Well, that's exactly right. And what's even more shocking is that they think that their religious beliefs entitle them to take the contract and not do the work underneath it. They say it would be a violation of their religious beliefs if they were required to follow the law and ensure access to emergency contraception and abortion for this vulnerable population. And they're just wrong in that legal argument. There is no right to a government contract if you're not willing to do the work under the contract.
And this is also a health care issue. You said that this falls under the jurisdiction overall of the Department of Homeland Security, or is Health and Human Services involved?
Health and Human Services is involved. So Homeland Security initially apprehends people who come across the border, and if they are a minor, then they are put into a Health and Human Services program, which is run by these various nonprofit organizations, including the bishops. So it very much is a health issue, and particularly, as we mentioned before, the sexual assault that is so prevalent across the border. And for a person who comes to the United States who doesn't speak English, who has been traumatized in her journey across the border, traumatized in her home country, forcing her to flee, to not know what laws are on abortion or contraception access, to even know if it's available in this country, you know, it's really the lifeline. Her lifeline is the social worker at one of these nonprofit organizations. And if that social worker is unable to provide access to reproductive health care, that teenager's not going to get it.
We're speaking with ACLU attorney Bridget Amiri. We'll be right back after this break. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with ACLU attorney Bridget Amiri about the denial of the Catholic Conference of Bishops of proper reproductive health care to the young women in their charge.
Paint a picture for us, if you will, of some of these young women, these girls, teenagers. If they're not reunited or united with a family member in the United States, are they in what kind of facility?
So it really varies. There are secure facilities for teenagers who might be a danger to themselves or others, and they're secure, almost prison-like facilities. And then there are also foster care-type situations that are available for long-term situations where either the teenager is not going to be able to reunify with their family for a long time or is seeking asylum here in the United States, which can take a while. And they're more like any sort of other domestic foster care system where there might be a group home or maybe placed with a family. But sometimes their mobility is very, very restricted.
So if one of these girls is pregnant, and I assume that it's actually a higher number, they could be in a foster care scenario or imprisoned and be pregnant and then deliver because they're denied service to abortion clinics, right?
Yep, absolutely. And that's one of our biggest concerns, is that these teens who might want an abortion are being forced to carry pregnancies to term against their will, and the consequences of that have to be absolutely devastating. So for someone who has already endured so much pain and suffering, abuse, sexual assault, to then be told that she can't fulfill what she wants with respect to her health care decisions, and then to be forced to carry a pregnancy to term and have a child is really devastating.
Bridget, if things go our way legally, what would you like to see happen?
Well, You know, I want to say that certainly the Catholic bishops are entitled to their religious beliefs, and they've done a tremendous amount of good work for immigrants who've come to the United States. You know, we would like them to just comply with the law and make sure that these teenagers who seek abortion and contraception have access to that service as they are entitled to under the law. And so we really want to make sure that everyone is provided with compassionate care.
Now, Bridget, if a teenager does give birth and she's in punitive custody, is the child taken away from her?
You know, it's an excellent question, and I'm not sure the specifics. I don't know that the child is taken away from her. I haven't heard those circumstances of that happening.
And my other question is, what kind of response is there from other groups? I mean, this is a story I had not heard of until I read about your FOIA request.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this is one outrage on top of another. First, the girl is abused in her own country. Then she's put into detention in this country. Then, if impregnated, forced to give birth to a child, we don't know what's going to happen to that child. Are grassroots organizations rising up in arms about this?
There are a number of organizations that are working on this issue. So we have done here at the ACLU a lot of work to ensure proper conditions at these facilities to make sure that any sort of process for deportation or asylum is fair. And there are also a number of other organizations that we partner with. So the Women's Refugee Commission, for example, has done a tremendous amount of work visiting these facilities, documenting what is going on, putting out reports, trying to get attention to it, trying to pressure the federal government to make sure that everyone is cared for properly and appropriately, and that they're not going to be deported to a country where they are going to suffer more abuse at the hands of the people who they fled from in the first place.
This seems to be like the latest chapter in an attempt to gut Roe versus Wade. So even though the right to have an abortion is on the books, it's been undercut. And I know you litigated the cases out in Texas with abortion clinics, and I wanted to ask you how that is going.
So the situation in Texas was pretty bleak. I was part of the first challenge in Texas, was not a part of the second challenge, but have been watching it very closely and keeping my clients apprised of the developments there. So Texas passed a law that had many components to it. It required that abortion providers and only abortion providers have admitting privileges at a local hospital, that imposed serious restrictions on medication abortion, and also that the law required abortion facilities to meet ambulatory surgical facility requirements, pages and pages of regulations about the physical plant structure, the width of hallways, janitor closets, and things like that. So the Texas abortion providers have really just been under siege, and after we lost the first challenge on admitting privileges, about a third of the abortion clinics in Texas were forced to close. And if the second challenge, which is still pending, isn't successful, there will be about 8 abortion clinics left in the state of Texas.
So even if an undocumented immigrant is picked up in Texas and is pregnant, and even if they're working with an organization other than the bishop's organization, they may not be able to get an abortion anyway.
Well, it's an excellent point. For women in general in this country, there has been a loss of access to abortion, both because of the legislative restrictions that are imposed and the violence against providers that make it a lot of providers unable and unwilling to enter into this profession. And so there's a dearth of providers already across the country, and then that dearth of providers means that access is so much harder for vulnerable populations, immigrant populations, teenagers, the very poor rural women. And so it's burden upon burden upon burden for these women.
Do you foresee a return to days of decades ago when abortion wasn't legal to self-induced procedures?
I think we're already seeing that now, particularly in Texas. There are a number of reports of women who are attempting to self-induce an abortion using a drug called misoprostol that is sometimes available at flea markets or across the border in Mexico. And what we want is for women to have access to safe and legal abortion. And we're really in a place already where some women are living in a situation as if Roe v. Wade was never decided, and because they don't have access to it, and they are taking matters into their own hands.
What's the immediate future for your lawsuit with regard to the Conference of Catholic Bishops?
So our first step is really to get the documents to really get a better sense of what's happening on the ground and what the federal government has done or not to ensure that children and teenagers in the care and custody of Catholic organizations have been getting the care that they need. And after we get the documents, we will make further assessments. Obviously, our biggest concern, as you alluded to before, is whether there is a violation of separation of church and state. The federal government should not be providing a multi-million dollar contract to a religious organization and allowing that religious organization to impose its religious beliefs on the vulnerable population it serves to the detriment of that population. And so that's our biggest concern.
Bridget, we really look forward to hearing of your continued efforts in this field. It's a grim situation that I'm sure our listeners will be interested in learning more about.
Before we say goodbye, is there a website or organization?
Yes, www.aclu.org is our website, and there is a menu of reproductive rights issues, and you can click on that, and it should take you to our various work.
Bridget Amiri, thank you so much for your fine work.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Victims of police torture under former Chicago Police Commander John Burge will share $5.5 million, receive an apology, and have their story taught in school under a reparations package. Besides a provision that calls for teaching the Burge torture cases in public school history classes, the ordinance includes a formal apology from the city council and psychological counseling and other benefits such as free tuition at community colleges. The ordinance also extends some benefits to victims' children or grandchildren. Burge, now 67 years old, was fired from the Chicago Police Department in 1993. He was never criminally charged with torture, but was convicted in 2010 of lying about torture in a civil case and served 4.5 years in federal custody. Still drawing from his pension, he was released from a Florida halfway house this February. Joining us now to talk about the landmark reparations package is Flint Taylor from the People's Law Office in Chicago.
Attorney Flint Taylor from the People's Law Office in Chicago, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be back again with you all.
Flint, you were a part of a movement in Chicago that recently won this most amazing, historically unprecedented victory to get reparations for the victims of Chicago police torture. We just couldn't believe it. This has never happened before anywhere in the United States. Tell us what happened, and then we'll talk about why.
Well, what happened was, after many years and actually many decades of struggle, both legal and political and movement struggle, we reached a point where there were some 50 to 60 survivors of police torture by the notorious police torturer out here, John Burge, who had never received any compensation or other remedy for their torture, because of the statute of limitations and other related legal problems. So and I use the term we in the sense of a movement that formed, together with the lawyers who had been fighting these cases for decades, focused part of our attention on the concept of reparations, i.e. restorative justice, based on things that had happened in other places like Chile and other places in South America, and also in a very limited way in this country, and also, of course, with the Japanese internment issues after World War II. So we mounted what seemed like, at that point, a terrifically long shot approach, but we thought politically it made a lot of sense. And in the same way that initially we fought to use the term torture when everybody wanted to use the kind the terms like police brutality and abuse. We fought to maintain the terminology reparations, even though we were counseled that that was too radical a term. And in any event, as we started to deal with some of these cases in the more modern era that did have the ability to get actual lawsuits filed because they had been exonerated, we started to raise the question politically and publicly about what about the other men who were tortured who don't have a remedy? What about compensating them? But more than compensating them, why don't we deal with the broader issues of the psychological care that they all need, of the education and the job training and all the kinds of things that, that would make for a kind of a whole, making a holistic approach to this. And at the same time, we wanted to look at the issue of memorializing this, to have an actual memorial, to have some kind of turn the educational aspect of it, the narrative, to have the true narrative of torture taught in the public schools, and to have a public apology, an official public apology. We had kind of forced an apology out of Rahm Emanuel a couple of years ago, but we wanted a formal apology by the city itself. And so these were some of the issues that we raised. It got some traction, we were able to negotiate a package with the city just after Emanuel was reelected. We were negotiating this all for a period of time before the election, and there was a tremendous amount of political agitation from the movement that supported this. And we actually reached a compromise, a historic, I wouldn't call it a settlement, but a reparations package. And as you pointed out, it's certainly the first of its kind with regard to police brutality and torture in this country.
Flint, Amnesty International USA applauded this proposal, saying it was unlike anything a U.S. municipality has introduced before. Do you hope that this might be a model that other jurisdictions can replicate going forward?
Yes, I should applaud Amnesty International because they were much in support of this and were one of the many groups who joined with us and, in fact, were participated in the negotiations with the city's Corporation Council to obtain this reparations ordinance. And I think certainly it's a model for other places around the country, but really it's much more a model and something that can be aspired to by the movements that are fighting against police brutality and police torture and other forms of injustice in this country. In other words, I don't think that cities or municipalities are going to say, hey, they did it in Chicago, let's do it here. But if, in fact, it is presented by a powerful movement and is raised in a way that resonates in the community, then I think that it could serve and should serve as a model around the country. And in that sense, the struggle for reparations is what's the model, as much as what we obtained, which of course is as significant as well. But in the sense that this is something, and as the City Corporation Council said at a hearing that we had, to approve or to raise with the Finance Committee of City Council, he said, we didn't have to do this. We did this because we wanted to do this. We thought it was right. Well, of course, cynics might say that it took them 30 years to decide that it was right, but whatever the reason, and the reason being that the movement, particularly in the context of an election where the mayor was vulnerable for criticism from the African American community and the progressive community, made them do the right thing. But they did do the right thing, not because they had to, but because political forces made them do that.
Flint, talk to us about the coalition that was put together that was successful in winning this huge amount, $5.5 million in reparations. What were the groups involved in this?
Well, it was a concept that we had put forward black people against police torture and People's Law Office and other organizations had conceptualized quite a period of time ago. But it was not something that had a movement behind it until about a year or two ago, when a terrific group that had originally started was a group of artists and other people who wanted to look at police torture in a different way here and did a lot of art and exhibits and that kind of thing with regard to police torture, took it on. And they took on the idea of reparations. And they then broadened the scope of the movement beyond the Chicago Torture Justice Memorial Project, which was the name and is the name of this organization that spearheaded this fight, and a lot of groups that dealt with racial injustice in this city, including young groups that had formed or who had been strengthened in around the fight, you know, like Black Lives Matter, and there's a group in Chicago called We Charge Genocide, which is a similar type of young youth organization. All came together. There's another very strong organization called Project NEA, and all those that became a real strong coalition with Amnesty International and Black People Against Police Torture, and of course the lawyers that had fought these cases for so many years. And rallies were planned. There was a very large rally just before the primary election, where we demanded that all the mayoral candidates come, and 250 people turned out for the rally. And we went around and we talked to all the aldermen. There were 50 aldermen in the city of Chicago. And we were able, over a period of time, of many meetings and agitation, to get 29 of the 50 aldermen to sign on to our reparations ordinance, which had been introduced by several progressive aldermen, Alderman Moreno, Alderman Brookins, Alderman Moore. So that we then had a majority of the city council, but this being Chicago, we knew that support would be illusory if the mayor didn't support it. So then the movement really focused on the mayor. A lot of demonstrations were held outside of his office. There were teach-ins. There was civil disobedience. There was a tremendous amount of activity that went on, particularly before the primary election, but continued after. And just about the time of the primary election, we started to enter these negotiations with the Corporation Council.
Flint, I have a question for you as you're talking about this, because it's quite an interesting history. How much do you think the fact that Rahm Emanuel was in a difficult election played into a role where he had to try and pick up some of the black votes, some of the Latino votes, et cetera?
Well, I think that the pressure of the election was significant, but it was interesting because they waited until after he was elected to make it public, and they were very, very concerned that it not come out before the election. So I think he was playing a delicate balance in his own mind, or in his handler's mind. On the one hand, he thought that he would get a blowback from the right wing and from the more conservative white forces, the police forces, if this came out before the election. On the other hand, he realized there was a tremendous amount of pressure that was being generated by the organizations that represented the African-American community on the other. So there was a delicate political balance, but there's no question that the thrust of the election and a threat of looking bad in terms of being against this and not supporting it was definitely a major factor, and we played into that very strongly because we wanted to bring this to a head before the election in terms of the negotiations, because we felt that the leverage would diminish after the election and after a point where he wanted to show the African American community that, hey, I'm not such a bad guy just because I closed all 50 schools in the African-American community. I'm the new Rahm Emanuel.
Well, I should add that even the New York Times, in a supportive editorial, said that the city of Chicago has paid out over the last 10 years $500 million as a consequence of their police department. But Flint, I wanted to ask you this, and I want to remind our audience we're speaking with Attorney Flint Taylor in Chicago. He's a founding partner of the Great People's Law Office. Flint, one of the provisions of the reparations, which I found especially gratifying, was the one that teaches what the cops did to these people in both the 8th and the 10th grades. And I wanted you to talk for a moment about that.
Yes, and you know, this is why it was so important to have a broad coalition of people. We had teachers, we had others, you know, as I said, artists, just a broader coalition than you normally would have. And they had the idea of broadening the reparations to such things as education and changing the narrative. And of course, one of the struggles that we've all been involved in for 30 years has been to change that narrative from, as I said, police abuse that nobody believes to police torture that everybody accepts. And yes, I think that that's extremely significant. And I've always felt, as you know, a lawyer that deals with people's issues, with justice issues, that the narrative that you're fighting for is as important, or if not more important, than the victories in court. And so this is really a terrific thing. The curriculum for it has to be worked out, and we have to make sure that it is a strong curriculum. But it's just something that I don't think has been done in terms of any other historical issue in this country, certainly not around justice issues, and certainly not where it's accepted as something that the powers that be, who, of course, write history, as we know, allow the people to write some of the history and make it, you know, formalize it in the terms of the curriculums taught in the schools.
Well, Flint, we've run out of time, and I want to thank you, but I have to say that it just brings joy to our hearts to think about you and the People's Law Office and the various people in this coalition going into these classrooms now and talking about the way things actually are. So, Flint, again, congratulations to you and the coalition that you worked with for winning this amazing reparations victory in Chicago. And we look forward to hearing for some more victories. Thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
You're welcome, and I do want to give a special shout out to my partner Joey Mogul, who was so important in this struggle and helped to bring this together.
Thank you, Joey.
Thanks, Joey.
So Bye. Long.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.